Hi, my name is Scott Bellis. I played Max Fennig on The X-Files, and you're listening to the X-Cast.
Welcome back, everybody, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Tony Black, and once again this week we are venturing out of the waters of looking at a specific X-Files episode, and we've got another interview, and I'm delighted we've finally been able to set this one up, as today I've got on the show the mastermind behind the amazing X-Files anthology pro series over this last year or so. It's Mr. Jonathan Maybury. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Happy to be here, Tony.
It's really good to finally get you on. You've been an incredibly busy man over the last few months.
It has not been a boring time, that's for sure.
That's true, yeah. And we will get into this as we go into the podcast, because most of you, I think, will probably be aware of Jonathan. He's a best-selling New York Times author. He's won the Bram Stoker Award more times than a lot of us have had hot dinners. and his output is nothing short of prolific and quite legendary. So we're going to talk a little bit about Jonathan, his career, his involvement in the X-Files, championing the X-Files anthologies, obviously, and we're going to see where this goes. So to start off with, Jonathan, I thought I'd ask you the five questions of X, which is what I ask every new guest who comes on the show to see what your X-Files fandom is like. So I'll start the ball rolling with the first question, which is, how did you first discover the X-Files?
I was there pretty much from the beginning. A friend of mine had seen the first episode and told me, you know, hey, dude, there's a show you've got to watch. And usually when my friends start a conversation that way, it never ends well for me, because it usually is something that would be canceled immediately, like Briscoe County Jr., which I loved and gets canceled. Or it's a show that clearly shows my friends have no idea what goes on inside my head. But this time, it was absolutely right. And he had seen the first episode, and this is back in the days of VHS. He lent me the tape. I'm like, what the heck is this? So we sat down to watch the next episode together, and that became the ritual. Eventually, I think by the end of the first season, there were about 16 of us crammed in a room watching The X-Files. Couldn't believe this was on television. So I came in on the second episode, and I have been a fan ever since, and have done whole rewatches of everything, and yeah, big. I consider myself part of the foundation of the X-Files.
Yeah, because you were there at the very beginning with a big group of fans getting into it, yeah. Right from Deep Throat onwards.
September 17th, 1993 was my introduction. One week after it started.
That's amazing. Did you stick with it to the very, very end of the show? So the very end of season 9?
I did, and I am not in the camp of people who hate Doggett and Reyes. I liked those characters. I understand that they were left in some trouble because, Duchovny wanted out, so they had to scramble to fix it. And, Chris Carter stepping away from it kind of damaged some of the mojo, but I like Doggett and Reyes, and I stayed with it to the end. I've seen both movies. I read the comic, which is written by a friend of mine, and I like the new season. So yeah, I'm like I said, right there the whole way. I'm an X guy.
An X guy. I like that. I like the X guy. I might have to borrow that. I'm a big fan of Joe Harris's comic, and we had Michael Dow Smith, who was on the who draws the comic on a few months ago, and I quite enjoyed the continuation series as well, the season 10. So yeah, it's great that you're on board. So if you've seen them all, then this shouldn't be a difficult question to answer. What would you say your favorite episode is?
Yeah, see, that's one of those funny things, because I have an odd mind in that I categorize things all the time. So I have like favorite horror episodes, favorite mythology episodes, favorite standalone episodes. But I guess the one that I go back to a lot is Darkness Falls. From it was late in the first season. I love standalone horror, And, you know, it's kind of an isolationist horror story. They're in that little cabin in the woods, has an unusual monster, which it's early in the X-Files, so that we didn't know what their monster of the week kind of thing was really going to be like. We didn't know, you know, some of the microscopic ancient creature things that they've done later on.
Mm.
And I only had one gripe, though, because it feels like they set up what could have been a movie or at least a two-parter. There's enough meat going in that it could have been a much bigger story. And I don't know whether it was budget constraints or they weren't yet doing the two-parter thing, but I think there was more story to tell. But I love the story that they told.
Yeah, it's from when we podcasted about this, we looked into it, and it was meant to be a bit of more of a bottle show, The Darkness Falls, and it ended up being one of the most expensive, time-consuming episodes of the first season when they originally planned it to be much more condensed. So that's possibly a reason why it didn't have the scope that you think it could have ended up having. I think it came out as one of the better season one episodes, though, so it's a good choice, that is. Yeah,
it is. And you know, they also did Ice in season one, which, you know, is an homage to The Thing. And having, you know, liked both versions of The Thing movie, the 1982 and the 1951, and the source material, I kind of like that setup too. But again, I think it could have been a movie. They had a bunch of episodes that they really front-loaded it with great setup, but then they realized, oh crap, we have an hour of television, we better wrap this up. So X-Files had a lot of lot of episodes where they could have gone more. I mean, granted, they had episodes where I couldn't wait for it to end too, like the one where they were in the virtual reality world. I honestly couldn't wait for that to end. The Fight Club episode, Jump the Shark episode. There were a couple that I didn't like, but man, the ones that I did like, really, really loved a lot. And I go back to them when I want to just immerse into good, creepy, moody storytelling. I'll go back to Darkness Falls, to Ice, and a few others.
Yeah, which are very similar kinds of stories. You know, Darkness Falls and Ice, yeah, they're a similar kind of template. So, no, that's that makes a lot of sense, definitely. What would you say your favorite season, then, is? Would you say it's season one, given you've mentioned a couple of episodes there?
It is. I'm a big fan of intelligent world building and myth building in storytelling, because I write series, you know, a lot of different series now. And so I like the fact that they hit the ground running with a lot of good structural stuff, setting up the dynamic between the characters, setting up the mythology, and so much of it was there in season one. I mean, yeah, there are seasons that got higher ratings. Like, I think 3 and 4 were really, you know, a lot of people consider that to be the prime X-Files. But man, they did some really great stuff in season one when they were still trying to decide what the show was that they were doing. I mean, you can tell that they were experimenting to see, well, I wonder if this is going to work or wonder if that's going to work. Some didn't, you know, the Jersey Devil episode did not work, because I know that myth very, very well. And that's, they got absolutely nothing from the real Jersey Devil legend in that story. So that, you know, that was a mistake. But overall, that season, you know, Deep Throat, you know, that whole stuff, they had great character actors. Season one is definitely my favorite.
I really like what you said there about the myth, building the myth element of the show there, because it that's a really good point. Not everyone looks at it in that particular way. You know, people think of it, season one, as being the season where they were just starting to find their feet and they hadn't particularly figured out the structure of the show and the characters and things like that. But you're right, there are a lot of myth, you know, building episodes and a lot of things that touch on very, you know, things like, you know, the face of Mars in space and all that kind of stuff. It's a really, really interesting way to look at that first season, definitely, because it does change as the years go on. So,
yeah, and it has that killer ending, the Erlenmeyer flask ending. Was like, I couldn't believe they did that. It's one of the few times I have sat there staring slack-jawed at a television going, you didn't just do that. And they did. They didn't try to retcon it the next season. You know, Deep Throat was dead. It's like, holy crap. How do you do that? And I mean, shock endings, season cliffhangers were not that common in TV. Especially in American TV, usually they had some tidy ending for the season, because they, a lot of American television in the 70s and 80s and into the early 90s were all about each episode more or less standing alone. X-Files pioneered that overall, you know, overarching mythology, and also the cliffhanger, which was simply not common. And now everyone copies that model. And I don't know if people give enough credit to X-Files for changing the dynamic and the way season-long television is presented.
Yeah, it did change the game, absolutely. And I think I'm glad you mentioned the Erlenmeyer flask, because I'm very much of the opinion that that's the best finale they ever did on the yes. X-Files, to date, anyway. It's yeah. an amazing end to a season. So, yeah, really nice to see season one get some love, Jonathan. That's great. Who would you say your favourite character, then, in the show is? Now, this doesn't have to just be Mulder and Scully, obviously. It could be anybody who's cropped up over the years.
Oh, boy. There are Clyde Bruckman is probably one of my favorites. That was in the one episode. Partly because Peter Boyle just made that a powerful, beautiful, funny character. And I'm a big fan of their powerful guest shots by interesting actors. And they've had, by the way, some incredible guest stars on that show. People don't realize. I mean, you know, Ryan Reynolds was on the show. Jack yeah. Black was on the show. Joe Morton, who's in Scandals. Aaron Paul, Dean Norris, and Bryan Cranston were all on the show. You know, so you have all these people that were on the show, and you can tell when they have a good actor in a one-shot role, they really – you see what acting is all about. They really sell it. So Clyde Bruckman is probably my favorite character in terms of the one that if I had to pick a supporting character or a guest character, stands out above all the others, even more than the Jose Chung character, which is so much fun. My favorite series character is definitely Scully.
Yeah.
Especially as the series went on and we realized that she kind of used to believe and even had some death visions. Like she saw her father. She, you know, I think it was a phone call from her sister. A couple of things that she had with dead people. And I thought that was really fascinating. And it always made me wonder, you know, what happened to her. So she was very fascinating. And she also has the biggest evolution. She goes from total skeptic to believer, kind of back to skeptic again. And you feel the sense of betrayal that every time she thinks she knows where there's a solid piece of ground to stand on, it gets shifted again. And I like that evolution.
So many people say Scully when I ask them this. It's so telling that I think Scully is the character who has stood the test of time even more than Mulder. And I think I've said this before on the podcast. I think a lot of people think there is no X-Files without Scully, perhaps even more than Mulder, which was obviously borne out in the last two seasons when he wasn't around much, and she was still a great character going through a great storyline. So, yeah, it makes sense, really, and I completely understand that point of view.
Yeah, and she has heart, even though it's buried under layers of things. And it's funny, a lot of people love Mulder because he's snarky and he's funny and he's intelligent and he drives the show. But it was an interesting comment a friend of mine made, a woman friend of mine back in the 90s, who said, Mulder is sexy, but he's not likable. Which is interesting, because he is kind of a jerk at times.
And he's
condescending, and he's a know-it-all. And Scully is trying to hold on to a certain belief system that she can defend her reason for holding on to it. Mm. But she does shift. They do. I think once they finally realized how good an actress they had with Gillian Anderson, they began to give her much more challenging emotional roles, and she played it with a lot of subtlety, and that made the character much more interesting.
Absolutely. And from Beyond the Sea in season one, which is one of my favorites, onwards, she just took the ball and ran with it whenever she got an episode like that. Absolutely. So it's Scully was recently voted, I think it was number 5 in the top 50 female characters by the Hollywood Reporter in a poll. So that's pretty good, and I think just deserved, really. So the final question in the 5 questions of X is, if you were to take a favorite moment from the series, from any of the seasons, from any of the episodes, what would you say stands out to you as the best moment of the X-Files?
Oh, the death of Deep Throat.
Because,
for a couple of reasons. One, it's great drama, and Jerry Hardin, the actor who played Deep Throat, was just brilliant in that scene. But it implied so much. Trust no one. And the way he said it, the way he sold that line, and the way the actors reacted to it, it actually gave me chills. Because this is I forget how many episodes were in the first season, 22 or 24. But by then, you know, we'd lived with these characters for a long time. Everybody was talking about the X-Files, and Scully and Mulder had become real people. So we became invested in what happened to them. And now their one lifeline gone, shot dead, gone, leaving them with something very, very scary. Trust no one. Not there are people you can trust, but don't trust these other guys. Trust no one. Holy crap. You know, so that That moment, I think, was one of the most powerful moments in television, not just in The X-Files, because of the implications for everything that was going to follow and everything that had led up to it. It pivoted on that trust no one moment.
Totally. And I think it stands the test of time. When you watch it now, that is still a shocking, you know, end to an episode. It still really does take you completely by surprise. So yeah, really good. Really, I think somebody else said this one actually in the past when we've had people on the show. I think it stands out absolutely. Okay, great. That's the five questions of X then for you, Jonathan. That's a good gauge of your fandom, really. So let's move on and talk about more about the X-Files. So we on the XCast blog have been reviewing all of the latest IDW publishing anthology about the X-Files called Secret Agendas over the last few weeks with all the different authors, many of whom have done blog interviews, some of whom are going to be coming on the show or have come on the show before, which is wonderful to talk about this and talk about the X-Files. And we're going backwards throughout in terms of reviews. We're going to do the Truth Is Out There, which is the second anthology, and then Trust No One. And we're going to do reviews of all of them and go through and discuss them, each story. And it's really great fun to go through it in that amount of detail. So my first question really, Jonathan, here is, how did this entire project come to be? And how did you, for Trust No One, which was the first collection of prose stories, how did it actually start?
Well, I was having lunch with Ted Adams, who's the CEO of IDW, and he's a friend of mine, and I had been doing some other projects for IDW's comics and my V-War shared world anthology series. And we were talking about the X-Files, and he knows I'm an X-Files fan, so is he. I was talking about the comic and how I thought Joe Harris was doing such a great job. And we just fell into a discussion of how we miss the fact that there are no new episodes and there was so much that could have been told between the old episodes, but that you'd have to get approval to be able to write those stories. I mean, they had the license to continue the show, but not the license to go back and expand on the original seasons. And I said, this would make great anthology. And we just start batting it around, Ted said, well, we should probably approach Chris Carter and Fox about this. And, IDW deals with licenses, so getting Chris Carter on the phone, getting Fox on the phone is easier for him than it is for ordinary mortals. Mm. So he got Chris Carter on the phone and said, Mayberry is interested in doing some X-Files anthologies. What do you think? And now, mind you, this is before they greenlit the new season, season 10. Yeah. And Carter's response was, well, who remembers the X-Files?
Oh, really?
I think Ted's answer was everyone. Like, Bush people in Africa are discussing episodes of the X-Files. I mean,
yeah.
Everyone, every single person. So Carter basically challenged him, saying, look, if Mayberry can get enough writers for an anthology, get back to me in a day or so and see what kind of response you can get. But they'd have to be good writers. So Ted said, well, how long, who do you think you could get? And I said, a lot of good writers. So I went off and I got home and I started sending out emails. About 45 minutes later, I had enough to fill the first volume from people who, were just super huge X-Files fans. Mm. And it wasn't like I was twisting anyone's arm. It's like eventually I was beating people off with a club because everyone wanted to get on this. And I made a mix too of writers who wrote horror, who wrote science fiction, and who wrote mysteries. So I had that interesting mix. And I contacted Ted, and he right away contacted Carter and Fox, and they greenlit the anthology, and they said, well, how many writers do you have that you can get firm commitments from? And I just fudged a number. I said 45. They said, okay, three volumes. And so I had to go out and get another 20, which took, I think, another half an hour.
Amazing. Amazing.
And since then, I've probably gotten 300 or 400 requests from people asking if they could be in the next X-Files anthology. Right now we'd only plan to do three. Doing more is not outside the realm of possibility, But we did those three, and I was so happy with the variety of writers, including some newbies, and the quality of the storytelling we got. So I feel like we did a good job. And then it's funny, somewhere along the way in this, you know, as we're getting ready for the first volume, I think we were in edits, we get a message passed down from Fox that there's going to be X-Files news, and then suddenly break the story that there's going to be a new TV series.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying we had anything to do with that, but, you know, him going, who remembers the X-Files, to, hey, we're doing more X-Files, it's an interesting coincidence. That's all I'm going to say. It's an interesting coincidence.
Well, you know, it could have helped. I mean, you know, bless him for thinking that way, that nobody remembers. It's just, the X-Files has never, ever gone away. You know, it's inspired so many people. People still talk about it every day. You know, it's amazing. And that he's being so humble there, thinking that way. So maybe it did, getting that massive response. And it doesn't surprise me that so many people just want to be involved in this.
Another thing that I think didn't hurt with our relationship with Carter for getting this done is asking, is the first volume selling out like within a couple of days? They underprinted it because, you know, everybody was afraid that, you know, Carter might be right, that there wasn't as much interest in X-Files. And like we put that came out and bang, gone. It's totally gone.
Yeah,
it's like that's not fast.
Well, I was going to ask that actually in terms of the sales figures, because they've been pretty good, I think, haven't they? You know, in terms of people, you know, for all three volumes, people wanting, you know, really lapping up this prose.
Yeah, those books fly off the shelves. Why shouldn't they? They're also official canon too, because we got permission. You know, we got verification from Carter that, you know, if as long as the stories. The challenge was to make sure the stories could fit between existing episodes and that they didn't change the mythology of any of the episodes. So, you know, I asked the writers to write stories as if they were going to be official canon, and they have, in fact, been accepted by Carter and Fox as official canon. They are now official X-Files stories.
That's fantastic. You headed off one of my questions, actually, which was going to be specifically about canon. So that is really good to know that they are considered to be, you know, the official adventures of Mulder and Scully.
Yeah. Yeah, and I tell you, everyone involved in the project, we were so happy about that, because I mean, there's when you're doing stuff that's not canon, even if you're getting paid for it, it still feels a little like fan fiction.
Yeah,
but if you're contributing to the official body of work, you're now part of that world. I mean, these writers, so many of them talk about how incredible it is to be part of that universe. You know, inextricably forever, these stories belong to the X-Files.
That's incredible. It must be so exciting and such an honor. And you know, the thing is, there haven't been that many actual novels. I mean, it's one of those rare TV shows that was an incredible phenomenon that, you know, if you look at things like Star Trek or Doctor Who, they have hundreds and hundreds of novels, if not more, you know, over the last, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. But now the X-Files has maybe half a dozen main novels over 25 years, and you think that's remarkable, really, as to how there have been, if you don't count the novelizations of the films, of course, but right. You know, there's been so few adventures of Mulder and Scully in the X-Files world in prose that to get these stories and have them as canon is fantastic, really.
I'm also surprised there weren't more novels, and I'm fortunate that I know most of the guys who wrote the X-Files novels. I knew Charles Grant, though he's since passed.
Mm.
Kevin Anderson had a number one international bestseller with his first X-Files novel.
Yeah,
and so of course he was one of the first people I asked to write a story for my anthologies, and he used that story to anchor the book. Is, I mean, it was such a great story. So I will not be surprised if more is not added to the body of work of the adult Scully and Mulder. And there's, of course, going to be teens. I guess we're going to discuss that in a bit. Teen Scully and Mulder stuff coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, since we're on that subject, we might as well talk about that now and take a bit of swerve into there, because that's a nice little cue to do that. So there obviously are two books coming out, aren't there? One by yourself and one by Cammy Garcia as well, which feature the younger days and the younger adventures of Mulder and Scully. So what can you tell us about them?
That has backstory. So the backstory there was, while we were doing the X-Files anthologies, I tried to pitch to Carter a young Fox Mulder anthology, because I thought it would be interesting, because he didn't used to be into UFOs. He was more into serial killers and conspiracy theories when he was younger. The UFO thing came during a hypnotic regression that he did. So I wanted to tell the pathway from, a traumatized kid into someone who's going to be one of the most celebrated FBI agents. But they didn't have enough enthusiasm for that. They didn't say, you know, their fear was the younger market wouldn't know who Scully and Mulder are, because the show had been off the air since, you know, before a lot of these kids were born. So being a little subversive, I asked Cammy Garcia, who's a friend of mine, to write me a young Fox Mulder story, and it came out in the second volume. She did a story called Black Hole Sun. Great story. And I did it just to prove that there would be, you know, positive response to it. And the response from viewers was really strong because it was a great story. And it also piqued interest. So based on that, I wanted to get, you know, a little more into this. And I wanted to start some X-Files, something I called X-Files Origins. You know, talking about the characters and how they got there. But as Cammy and I talked about it, we realized it would be better as a series of novels rather than short stories, because teens tend to read more long fiction than short. Mm. So it was eventually pitched to Imprint, which is a division of Macmillan. And with Cammy writing the young Fox Mulder novel about him at 17 years old, living in Washington, D.C., and how he gets kind of hooked on the whole serial killer thing. And then I would write the young Dana Scully novel about how she went from being the believer that is they allude to that she used to be into being a skeptic. What happened? And she's 15 years old living in Maryland. So that got pitched. It got approval from Chris Carter and Fox as official canon. Then now we're writing the official – well, we actually wrote. They're coming out in a couple of weeks. We wrote the first two of what we all hope is going to be a series of novels about young Scully and Mulder. They won't, of course, ever meet, because they didn't meet until the X-Files. But there are characters from the X-Files world that do show up. Like, there's a character in one of the episodes – or two of the episodes of X-Files. They call him the Red-Haired Man, played by Stephen McHattie.
Yes, yes, and, I remember.
It gave him an actual name in the script, Malcolm Gerlach. So I'm using him, a younger version of him, as kind of the behind-the-scenes villain in Scully's story.
Amazing.
There's a diner in the town that was Skinner was in one episode. He was in that diner. The fictional town that I'm using was mentioned in one episode. So there are little Easter eggs. There's even the well-dressed man from the Syndicate shows up. And it's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff. It's expanding the Syndicate's history from the late 70s. So we know more about, you know, their super soldier program and some of their manipulation programs to essentially scout for talent. And it was a lot of fun to do that, to expand with that, to explore that, rather. And, you know, Cammy wrote a brilliant novel called The Agent of Chaos, which is about Mulder. And I did Devil's Advocate, which is about Scully.
I think it's amazing that, A, it's canon, and B, well, I mean, firstly, it's amazing we're getting more actual books. After what I just said about, you know, there haven't been that many in history, it's great that we're getting some new ones. Second thing is that it's great, it's canon. And the third thing is, I think it's great that it's actually allowing the, you know, the backstory of the X-Files to be fleshed out in this manner, because... You know, obviously the show did a lot of stuff like that, you know, in terms of the actual on screen. But to be able to do that in a book, and for Chris Carter and Fox to actually say, you know, this is what happened, but we're seeing it, it's amazing. It's great that the opportunity is there to do that.
It is, and it's also an indication of how the world has changed a bit too. Because when the X-Files first came out, you know, this is before Harry Potter, and Harry Potter, those books changed the young adult market in publishing. From something that was, you know, flying largely below the radar to one of the biggest and most powerful aspects of publishing. Mm. So they couldn't really have done that back then. And, I mean, they had some young Fox Mulder or young X-Files stuff and young Jedi Knight stuff, but they were almost done as kind of like, I'm not saying throwaway, because friends of mine wrote those books, but they were not canon and they were not promoted. You know, they were pretty much just there for the, you know, the kids whose parents were watching those shows. And because they weren't canon, there was no way to invest deeply in the characters. And when you have something that's official, the kids can get into it. Their parents may wind up reading the books too. And I found that with my own young adult fiction that a lot of parents will get into the books too. Mm. And so partly because their kids are reading it, partly because, you know, it's a fun adventure. And it deepens that world.
And there's the, like you say, there's a great overlap because, yes, more as many people read Harry Potter who are adults as children. And there is a fantastic overlap. So you will have plenty of X-Files fans obviously read this who are adults as fans, but you'll also it will also appeal to younger viewers and people who are just discovering the show. And it could even be that it's one of the triggers that gets them younger readers into the TV show itself. So it's amazing. It could feed back onto each other. That's the beauty of it. And it's great that it's going to be, hopefully, a continuing series. That's even better. So how many, roughly, do you have you got planned, can you say?
Well, officially, we don't have, you know, we've only had little conversations about it. You know, because this is kind of a risk that they're taking because they don't know what the young adult market will do, we're not making plans for more until we see what the sales are for the first books. So I imagine sometime in January, we're going to start having conversations. That said, I know Cammy has a bunch of ideas, and I've got, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 stories I'd like to tell about Scully, because the transition from believer to skeptic isn't – I mean, we started – And go a pretty fair way into it in the first book, but there's a lot more to tell. The exploration of how hurt shapes a person is, you know, that's not something you can fully explore within one tale.
Yeah, it's a longer process, isn't it? What's interesting as well is that, and I'm wondering if this is coincidence or this is part of a bigger plan, but there was recently just finished a 4-part comic series called X-Files Origins, which was about Mulder and Scully as young children.
That's spun off of this. When I had pitched the X-Files Origins, I also included Ted Adams in IDW in our pitch to explain what we're doing. And then they decided they wanted to do that, but they didn't want to adapt our comics or our books into comics. So they decided just to go 2 years earlier and do more of a middle grade as opposed to the young adult that we're doing. So it's set 2 years before that. But it's part of the same X-Files Origins meta world.
So these stories are all connected within the same, within canon, within the same. So you will treat those comics as part of your own internal canon.
Yes, and there's even some slight references to it. We didn't want to hit the references too hard because comic readers and novel readers aren't as big a crossover as we would all like. But we do have references to those events. Those events took place in the same world, so we respect that material. And also, they did a good job with those comics too. So,
oh yeah, you know,
we want to make sure that they get the props for, you know, doing the kind of compelling storytelling that the X-Files deserves.
That's so good. That is so great to hear that they're connected, because there's nothing better than for a fan like me and many people who are going to be listening to this podcast who read all this stuff to know that they are all part of the same connective world, and you can look out for potential hints and clues and, you know, little callbacks and things. And that's amazing that it, you know, it's crossing now from not just television but into books, into comics, and it's covering the entire media world of the X-Files. And I think that's so great that you're able to capture all of those elements.
Yeah, and it's fun too. It's there's even the possibility I may step in and do some X-Files comics at some point. That's being discussed.
Oh wow, okay.
A lot of it would be, I mean, not, I certainly don't want to crowd Joe Harris, who's doing a great job, but should he decide to take a break, I have some ideas I would like to explore. And I, you know, I've got a track record in comics, and not just in superhero comics, but in horror comics as well. So
That would be amazing. That, you said earlier that you're a fan of what Joe Harris is doing. Have you? I take it you've read all of the season 10, season 11, and then the revival comics that he's now doing alongside the new season 10.
I catch up with his stuff when it comes out in trade. I'm one of those comic book readers who don't have the time to do every month. So when it comes out in trade, there's a slight lag with the stuff he's doing and when I will actually read it. But I've gotten up to, I think I'm about 10 issues back of his stuff, but I've really dug everything he's done, and the artist has been amazing. And
yeah, it is really great. It's really, really interesting, intelligent stuff, and the way he's, you know, he's managing to weave all this stuff, all these different, you know, effectively these different universes together. And now it's really, really good. And it's a real thrill to see all this X-Files extended media, you know, not just outside of the TV show, because obviously we don't know right now whether we're going to get season 11. It's still, as of recording this, it's still up in the air, and there's been word that it's not going massively well. So, you know, that might just be a rumor, but we don't know yet. We're going to get more on television, so it's great that 2017 is going to see plenty of X-Files media, as 2016 has as well.
Yeah, I would be willing to bet that there's going to be a season 11 of X-Files. I would say that's more likely than not that we are.
Oh, I'm believing in you, Jonathan. Here, I think I really am. I want to believe. I really do. As cheesy as it sounds, just going back to the anthologies briefly, in terms of the process and getting authors to come board, you talked about how for the first anthology you recruited people and things like that. Were there any other methods you used to get authors to become involved in any of these, not just obviously Trust No One, but all three of them? Did you just seek people out, or did they apply, or what was the actual system with it?
Yeah, it's funny about that. There are a couple different ways to do anthologies. Some people like doing open call. You know, I would rather be eaten by rats than do open call. not because I think you don't get good stories, but because it takes too much time. And right. I'm a really busy writer. I write between 4 and 5 novels a year, about 20 short stories a year, and comics.
Yeah,
so I write about 1.25 million words for publication while also editing 5 to 6 anthologies. I don't have time to read a couple of thousand stories coming in. So I do almost everything I do with anthologies is invitation only. I think about the mix of writers that I want. And I also have this thing where I have to not only like their writing, I have to know something about the writer in terms of how well they play with others. I don't like with prima donnas, and sometimes there aren't many prima donnas in the writing world, not as many as people think, but they're there. And so I like writing with people who are enthused about the X-Files. I mean, that had to start with they have to know the X-Files and love the X-Files. And they also have to be able to play well with others, and they have to be able to, you know, be part of a project together. They have to be a team player. They also have to have good work habits, because I need those stories in, done well, and on schedule, because, you know, we have a schedule with this. And the books were put out pretty quickly. I mean, we had 2 X-Files anthologies out this year, so that's pretty quick.
Yeah.
And so when I filled my rosters, I made a list of about 100 people I would go after, but I wound up getting the first 45. Everyone said, nobody said no to me on this. Not one person turned me down on this.
Well, it's funny. I was going to ask you that, actually. I was going to say, was there anyone you couldn't get for whatever reason, whether it didn't work out? But that's amazing that pretty much everybody said yes.
Yeah, and I mean, there were some people I had considered for stretch goals. Like, it would have been nice to have a Stephen King story, but I know he's booked years in advance.
Yeah, yes.
So I didn't ask Steve.
He'd have done it, though, probably, wouldn't he? If he had the time, I'm sure he would, because he's a huge fan, isn't he? He wrote an episode, so...
He wrote an episode, and he's a big fan, but I honestly don't think he does, you know, I don't think he likes doing media tie-in stuff, which is what this is, okay. Where he writes in someone else's world. He likes writing in his own world. And I've talked to him about the writing process and talked to him about things, and I don't think we could have gotten him for this. So everyone that I asked, I got. And, you know, some people are not necessarily well-known to the public, but I know their writing, and I also know how much they love the X-Files. So, you know, there's a range. And I got the first 45 people that were on the top of my 100 must-get list. That gave me 3 volumes. I think we went up with 46, because volume 3 had 16 stories.
Mm. Just finally, with the anthologies, were there any particular, like, stories or characters that you wanted to avoid? Or was it open season? Did you say to everyone, right, you just go away, you come up with an idea that fits within... you know, the history of the show, within the between the episodes, which everyone did really well. They all leapt off quite often little episodes specifically, whether it was Mulder and Scully coming back from the, you know, the prison at the end of the list and things like that. Was there anything that you were trying to avoid, though, specifically?
Well, we wanted to avoid stories. Well, first off, we got a lot of people who wanted to do a Skinner story. 2/3 of the female writers wanted to do a Skinner story. And I'm like, no, we can't have 10 Skinner stories per volume. And we also, well, I mean, from the beginning, I said, people, you have to pitch me a story and pitch where it's going to fall. And, you know, in terms of the overall season, you know, which season, where it's going to fall between all episodes. then pitch me a story that fits. And I think the biggest challenge we had was making the stories appropriate to the time frame.
Yeah.
Like we have I think one or two stories that are set in a more contemporary time frame, but we had people, you know, in original stories set in the 90s texting on their phones or taking cell phone pictures, and that really wasn't a thing then. So those stories either had to be changed the date in which the story was taking place. That kind of helped us shape it. But it's really, I had them pitch stories to me. And, you know, I took the pitches to the licensed guy at Fox, and we discussed them back and forth, Josh Izzo. We you know, made some decisions, and we would go back to the writers with some notes, and then they would write stories for us. So, we had to make sure that we were going to get stories that actually fit rather than a story that we then had to heavily edit in order to fit. And everybody was game with it because, you know, that's how licensed projects work. And we all wanted to make sure that our story was, or their stories were accepted as canon.
And you, like you said, that was the key reason for why you needed people who understood and knew the X-Files, which, you know, you got the feeling pretty much everybody did, you know, who wrote for these. You know, it was a real feeling when you're reading these stories. You think, yeah, these people know the show, and that's what's really good about it. So yeah, I think overall it's just been a really great 3-volume process. And yeah, let's, as you said earlier, it's possible we might get some more, so let's hope that with those and the new, you know, young adult Mulder and Scully novels, we can keep this going. I'm certainly hopeful for another anthology or three, Jonathan.
yes, me too. And there are some other projects that are being discussed that I can't talk about yet that would also play to this audience. And a lot of it depends, again, on how these perform. And well, some like Secret Agendas, the third volume is out. So it was only recently out, and that we don't have sales numbers yet. So, you know, as much as we would love every book to be able to, you know, have as many sequels as possible, it always comes down to sales numbers because publishing is a business.
Yeah, of course.
But that said, everybody likes the X-Files. So I got a feeling that there's going to be a lot more fun for us to have. And since I did my original list, I've actually added a lot of names to my list of who I might want to write an X-Files story for me. So there's going to be no shortage of top talent.
That's exciting. That is exciting. Well, my fingers are massively crossed there. In terms of new projects, whether they're anthologies or original works or novels or anything, what specifically are you working on now, or what's coming up as well as the X-Files that people who like your work can check out?
I hope you have a comfortable chair, because I've got a ton of stuff coming up. I've got, like, just in the next couple of months, you know, I've got in January the X-Files. In April, I've got two novels coming out in April. One is for young adults called Mars One, about the first family's going to live on Mars. It's already in development for film. Then I've got the ninth in my Joe Ledger thriller series coming out at the end of April. And that's, you know, that's also in development for film right now. So there's a lot of interest in that. Over the next year, though, I've got an Aliens, you know, from the Alien movie franchise, Aliens Bug Hunt anthology, which is all stories of colonial marines fighting different types of aliens in the universe. And that was a bunch of fun to do because, you know, we got some hard science fiction, horror stories in that. The dream project that I was working on for years in my head and finally pitched was one where I wanted to do an anthology of stories set in the world of Night of the Living Dead, but have them as official canon as well. And I know other people have approached George Romero about this over the years, and it's not gotten anywhere. And I finally got to the point in my career where I could make that phone call. I went up to George on the phone, and I'm all front-loaded, ready to try to convince him. And we're like 5 minutes into it. It's, oh, yeah, I read your book, Dead of Night. I think it's fantastic. Great zombie novel. Let's do this.
Wow. Like,
okay. And he said, but I have three conditions. And I'm bracing myself because when somebody says conditions, that could be an issue. However, his first condition is that instead of just greenlighting it, he wants to co-edit it with me. Like, that's not the problem. the second condition, he says, and I want to write a story for it. I'm like, really? I think we can arrange that. And the third condition, he said, you know, having read your book, Dead of Night, which I did the zombie novel called Dead of Night, and I dedicated it to him. And I had written the book originally because, you know, I saw Night of the Living Dead when I was 10, when it first premiered. Actually, the first night it premiered.
Amazing.
I snuck into the theater. but I was always annoyed about the cause, which is, you know, they alluded to it being radiation from a returning space probe. And I'm a science geek, and that doesn't make any sense. So I wanted to write a book in which the zombie apocalypse happens, and there's a plausible scientific explanation. I worked with scientists to come up with one. Dedicated the book to George Romero, and the events are set so that it can lead up to the events in Night of the Living Dead. Well, apparently he thought so too. So his third condition was, he says, I want you to write a story that officially connects your book Dead of Night to Night of the Living Dead. Because as far as I'm concerned, that's how this all started.
So your original, your work now is part of, or it's going to be part of that universe.
Yeah, well, what it does, it connects, you know, the Dead of Night and Fall of Night, the two books that I wrote. They're now the official prequel Night of Living Dead, according to George Romero, and he is the arbiter of this. And then I have a story that actually brings us up to the house where things take place in Night of the Living Dead. So all the stories that, you know, and I usually don't contribute a story to an anthology unless it's a requirement by the publisher. If I'm editing, I usually try to just edit. But in this, he wanted me to write a story for it. And every story that we got in had to be set in the 48 hours surrounding Night of the Living Dead. And that comes out in July. So that's a big project for me.
What a thrill, though. What a thrill to actually be that connected. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, 10 years ago, I this is a phone call I could never even have imagined. And now, you know, I pick up the phone, I talk to George Romero, and it's like yeah, that happened this Tuesday. Okay. It's nuts. I mean, there's a part of my entire career that is surreal. And if this is a dream and somebody wakes me up, I'm going to kill them.
That wouldn't be a good way to end 2016. It's been a tough enough year for a lot of people. Yeah. Oh dear, that's amazing though. That is amazing. Is there anything else while we're here, or are those the key ones really that are coming up?
Let's see. I've got my second short story collection coming out called Wind Through the Fence, with an introduction by David Morrell, who the creator of Rambo, great writer.
Cool.
The first one came out with introduction by Kevin J. Anderson.
Oh, great.
And that just came out. And I'm actually ending the year with a release. It just came out last week. Kind of a weirdo release in that the audiobook version, I have a collection of short stories. The audiobook version and the print version are different stories. And it was a weird license that came along after we'd already sold it. It's called the print version is called Beneath the Skin. It's all stories about this werewolf private investigator that I have. There's a whole bunch of stories in there, some of which are reprints from books published by the publisher who's also doing that, Journalstone, and an original story. But the audio version by Blackstone has only two of the same stories because the rights wouldn't, you know, there was a rights problem in getting the audio people to get the same rights for the stories. Very complicated. So the audiobook has five short stories, and only two of them are the same as the print version. So They last minute they changed the title to the Sam Hunter Collection, but they both came out, and they're a lot of fun. It's one of my favorite series to write. It's a character I only do in short stories, and they're noir werewolf stories about a PI. There's a little bit of folklore. Real quick story. There's folklore in Europe. About a creature, a race of creatures called the Benedanti, who are werewolves who fight evil. Right. And it goes back, you know, hundreds of years. And so I create a character who is a werewolf. And when he accepts a client, it's like he's taking someone into their pack. And he'll do anything to protect his pack.
Mm.
And so the stories get a little nasty at times, but they're fun.
Yeah.
And we're about to break some other big news soon about some books there's a good chance that my first three novels, the Pine Deep series, will be optioned for television. So
that's fantastic.
Lots of stuff happening right now. And, yeah, you put a bunch of irons in the fire hoping something is going to get hot, and then suddenly they all get hot.
It's like buses coming along at once, you know. It's always the case.
I'm complaining about, mind you.
Well, that sounds like an incredible 2017 coming up, Jonathan. After a great 2016, where everything, you know, is continuing to take off. And I think, I really think I speak for, you know, the majority of listeners of this and the X-Files fandom to say thank you for, you know, really crafting out some amazing stories in this world we love so much. And it's just been a real thrill to see these anthologies. And now, obviously, you know, the new Mulder and Scully books coming out. So thank you ever so much for doing it, because it is great and it just keeps this world alive. And I think we're all really grateful for that.
Well, I thank you for saying that. And it's nice to know that there are people who are, or so many people who are into the X-Files and who respect that and have fun with it. Having fun with it's big. And, you know, I've been listening to your podcast. You guys clearly have fun with this.
And well, thank you.
That's really, really key for me because it's the core of my business model. If it's not fun, I don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a wise way to look at it, definitely. Well, I've got one more question before we wrap up, Jonathan, and it goes back to the X-Files in many ways, but it's a bigger question. So, and I ask a lot of people this. So, Jonathan, do you believe in the paranormal?
I do. But I'm somewhere between Scully and Mulder. I believe in it, but I would like a little bit of proof now and again. I keep a very open mind. My grandmother taught me a lot about what she called the larger world when I was a kid. And I keep a very open mind. But if I see a light in the sky and I can't identify it, I don't immediately decide which planet it's from, what their agenda is, and so on. It's unidentified until, you know, and I have theories about UFOs, theories about the paranormal. I've written them into a lot of my novels. My novel Extinction Machine is all about – it reflects my theories about why we – if there are aliens, why we haven't had meaningful conversations with them. But, yeah, I keep a very open mind, but I do like proof. So I'm looking. I want to believe.
Perfect answer, really. Perfect answer. You sit in the middle of the two dichotomies of Mulder and Scully. So, yeah, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. So, yeah, it's been a real, real thrill to speak to you, Jonathan. It's been so great, you know, for going through all this and discussing all these projects. Where can people find you online if they want to find out more about what you're doing and all these different, you know, as you say, irons in the fire?
Well, I'm all over social media, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, all those places. The only challenge in finding me is spelling my name right. Most people, the immediate tendency when they hear Mayberry is to spell it M-A-Y.
M-A-Y.
M-A-B-E-R-R-Y, spelled like Mawberry. So if you look for Jonathan Mayberry with the correct spelling, you'll find my website, my Facebook, my Twitter, and everything else. And I'm very active on social media. It's actually me, not a publicist interacting. Because I like talking to my fellow pop culture geeks, because I have been one for a long time. And I like talking pop culture with folks. So please find me online.
Well, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And remember that key distinction, guys. M-A-B, not M-A-Y-B. Very, very, very key, yes. Very key. yeah, Jonathan's all over social media, so that's great. Do look him up. And make sure on the 4th of January you're there to buy these books. Well, by the time this podcast comes out, actually, we will have should have just passed the 4th of January. I think that will have just been a couple of days ago. So these books should now be available on Amazon and all bookstores and things like that. So it's Agent of Chaos by Cami Garcia, Devil's Advocate by Jonathan. Make sure you buy them. We'll be buying them. We'll be doing some podcasts on them. But yeah, it's make sure you go and check buy those books, guys. Keep this fandom going. Keep these projects alive because they're amazing. I'm sure you all will anyway, and we will cover them on the show next year. Well, this year, I should say. So yeah, we are recording this before Christmas, guys. As you can tell by me making sure I'm thinking ahead. We're obviously on Twitter. You can find us at @X_cast. We've got a group on Facebook, the X-Cast podcast fan group. So look us up on there. We've got a page if you just type in the X-Cast. We're on iTunes. If you type X-Cast in and, you know, do leave us a review and a rating, that'd be great to help us get found even more. And we've got the blog with loads of great writers having loads of fun writing articles. And we're going to dabble in a little bit of fan fiction ourselves, inspired by Jonathan's project, actually, inspired by the anthologies. We're going to try and do that this year and do our own little homage, which would be nice. So, yeah, look us up on there. We're all over that and for the X-Cast world we're building. So, once again, Jonathan, such a great thrill to speak to you. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and hopefully we can get you on again.
Yeah, this has been a lot of fun, so thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. And, we'll be back soon, guys, for a brand new episode covering something to do with the X-Files. It always changes, so I'm not going to predict it, but you will be back. And remember, as ever, trust no one.